Fasten your seatbelts and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip. Water is pure. Water is natural. Water is healthy. Water can help all. Water is simple. Water is free. Water can help the lives of you and me. A poem by Olivia Taylor. St. Francis of Assisi once said, "Water is the mirror of nature." "We never know the worth of water till the well is dry," said Thomas Fuller. We all need clean water to survive, yet we often take it for granted. It will always be there, right? In Wisconsin, Governor Tony Evers has made water quality a top issue, proclaiming this the year of clean water. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss has created the Water Quality Task Force with strong representation from Central Wisconsin, including its Vice Chair, Representative Katrina Shanklin of Stevens Point. How do we come together as a state to ensure clean water and support economic development at the same time? That's the underlying theme of the upcoming Wisconsin Lakes Partnership Convention, April 10th through 13th in Stevens Point, and surrounds the work of our guests today on Route 51. I'm Rick Ryer. Joining me today is Eric Olson, Director and Outreach Specialist with UW Extension Lakes. He helps lake organizations increase their capacity to be active players in protection and the restoration of Wisconsin's water resources. We also welcome Patrick Goggin. Patrick is a Lakes Outreach Specialist with UW Extension Lakes, where he helps homeowners and lake organizations get involved in shoreline restoration and protecting healthy lakes. Before joining UW Extension Lakes, in 2008, Patrick was a county conservationist for Vilas County and the Land and Water Conservation Department. And for this segment of the program, we are joined by Dr. Kate Brauman. She's from the University of Minnesota Institute for the Environment, where she is the lead scientist for Global Water Initiative. She studies the coupled interaction of land use change and water resources, and she brings together the study of hydrology and plant-water relations with economics and policy to explore the effects of land cover and water delivery to downstream users. Late in the program, we'll talk with Dr. Douglas Talamy from the University of Delaware. Eric, Patrick, Kate, welcome to Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Good morning, and thank you for having us.
Good morning.
It's great to be here.
It's great to have you here as well. We'd also like to hear from you. Our number is 800-780-9742. What concerns or solutions do you have about our lakes and waters in Wisconsin? 800-780-9742 is our phone number. Kate Brauman, tell us a little bit about the Global Water Initiative and your research relating to economic policy and water delivery.
What we're doing with the Global Water Initiative is really trying to provide context for how we think about water use and water quality and what we're doing with water. So a lot of that has to do with what's going on upstream. What are the different things that we're doing on the landscape? Oftentimes we're not doing those things because of water, but they have impacts on water. So whether that's farming or mining or cities, we don't build those things because of water, but they do impact water. And so understanding what that looks like, understanding if there's better ways to design those systems so they have better water, and then looking downstream to try to understand where is our water coming from, and again, what are we doing with it? Are we irrigating crops? Are we drinking that water? Is it in lakes where we want to fish and swim? And so trying to bring all of those pieces of the landscape together through the flow of water is really what we're working on.
Well, tell us a little bit more about your work with economic policy and water sources.
So a big piece of that is trying to understand what is the value of changes in water quality and changes in water availability, and how do we assess that? And so what benefit are we getting from using water in different ways? What benefit are we getting from using water in more efficient ways? And then also, how much does that cost us? So trying to look at, for example, if we want to make investments in improving lake water quality, what are the things that we would have to do upstream to make those changes, and how much would that cost us? And then what would the benefit be in terms of what we see in the lake in terms of our ability to fish or swim or look out from our houses and see a clear lake or a lake that's all full of scummy algae?
Well, here in the U.S., how has combining economics and ecology helped thinking as it relates to balancing environmental concerns and economic development?
I think it's been really, really critical, because one of the things that is easy to forget is that there is actual economic value to having a clean and healthy environment. There's lots of things that are easy to put a price on. We know exactly how much the house next door sold for. We know how much we're willing to pay for groceries or a car, or even for more complicated things like childcare. But a lot of times the goods and services that we get from the environment are free. They're shared by everyone, and there's not a market price for them. But that doesn't mean that they're without value. And so taking different approaches to looking at, well, how much is it worth to us? Are we willing to travel further to go to a lake that's more scenic or cleaner? Being able to put a price on nature in that way lets us integrate it with the kind of decision-making tools that we use every day. So cost-benefit analysis, for example, is it a good investment to change water management, to put in a new water treatment plant in this city? Is that going to get us a benefit downstream that's valuable to us?
Are there any drawbacks to assigning a monetary value to nature?
Definitely. I think a lot of people have real concerns about the idea of commodifying or putting a price on nature, and that's very real. And it's very similar to the feelings that we have about our families, about lots of things that we care about that aren't consumer goods. And it's really important to remember that when we talk about economics and we talk about these kind of policy decisions, we're not talking about the value of nature. We're talking about the economic benefit of making some change, and is that little change a big enough value that we want to make that investment? You know, I often come back to family when I think about how to think about this for myself and at home. You're going to make a decision, for example, about where you might put your kid in daycare. And there's going to be different costs, and there's going to be different benefits, and they're going to have all kinds of different aspects, and you make a choice. You have personal values, and you're going to put that into it. None of this is actually related to the value of your child. And similarly with nature, you know, we think about, well, gee, do we want to manage water this way? Do we want to manage water that way? Is it going to improve our water? Can we do different things with it? And that's really what the economics is doing, is putting some numbers on that so that we can come to the table and make policy decisions. And it's not about the intrinsic value of nature in any way.
So this really is a new way of thinking about the impact that we have on the environment and our water resources, correct?
Yes and no. I think even as we go back to things like the Clean Water Act in the early 70s, we looked at nature and said, gee, when our streams catch on fire, we don't like that. And so that was, you know, that was, I think, one of the places where we first started thinking about, okay, well, what's the value of cleaning this up? It's going to cost businesses some amount of money to do their water treatment, but there's a benefit to it that's important to us. And that's one of the places that this comes from. So it's not brand new, but we're getting a lot better at it.
Well, tell us a little bit more about what you're going to be talking about at the convention in April.
So this idea, first of all, that, you know, value isn't cost, is really, really important. And that's one of the things that I want to make sure that we're all on the same page about. But then one of the things that I'm excited about is talking about some of the different ways that we are becoming able to put a cost on nature. There's some really neat evolution in how we're able to do some of this. So, for example, in Minnesota, one of my colleagues was actually able to use data from pictures on the internet. So people going out and taking pictures of lakes and posting on the internet, not just the picture, but where that picture was taken and also where they're from, and was able to actually figure out how much further people are able to, are willing to drive in order to get to a lake that's a little bit cleaner. And that's pretty exciting. That is people are actually spending more money. They're spending more time in cars. They're putting more effort into going further for cleaner lakes. And what that tells us is that there's a real quantifiable monetary benefit to making sure that our lakes are cleaner in terms of how much people want to visit them.
That's really an incredible idea. Knowing from my experience, I would like to know ahead of time, boy, that's a cleaner lake. I'm certainly going to drive there to fish versus here. That's incredible. Eric Olson, what do you hope people will come away with from Kate's talk at the convention?
Sure. So we're really trying to broaden out our thinking about lake protection and restoration from maybe just sort of a thing that people want to do just because they want to see the lakes cleaner or the rivers cleaner, to something where people say, you know what, it just makes economic sense to do it this way. Like, we're going to receive a benefit that, as Kate is suggesting, it's difficult to quantify sometimes, but it's very real. And so if hundreds of lakeshore property owners, thousands of lakeshore property owners can enter into this conversation and can engage policymakers locally and at the state level, we think that's going to elevate the discussion about natural resources. I'll just give one quick example. The Stewardship Fund in Wisconsin is a program used to purchase land and easements to protect land from development. And a lot of people talk about it in terms of, oh, well, that'll be nice. It'll be cool to have this area I could visit. We could go up there and hunt sometimes, or we could go for a hike. But we never put into that equation, well, what's the water quality benefit of protecting that land from harmful development? But that's a very real benefit, okay? So the folks who are like in northwest Wisconsin, there were several flood-causing storms in the last couple of years. They're looking around and realizing that those storms and the floods could have been way worse if some of that landscape hadn't already been put into county forest or into state ownership, because those wetlands were never drained. And so those wetlands served as sponges to help absorb at least a portion of the storm. So that's part of the conversation we really want to have, is just to elevate it. And really, we know that in this day and age, policymakers, elected officials, they do want to see the numbers. They want to know the hard facts. How does this all balance out? There isn't an infinite amount of money to put into these programs. So how do we keep building the case? It's not that economics is the only part, but boy, if you can add it on to a lot of the other pieces, it starts to be really compelling.
Patrick Goggin, how can we apply this model to the water issues we're facing here in central Wisconsin specifically?
Yeah, I'll give you another example. Some counties and towns have looked at their tax rolls and waterfront properties as it relates to those tax rolls and how important those waterfront properties are to the base of that local economy. Well, if the water in those lakes goes south and gets degraded, that tax base is going to be lessened. And so just that understanding between town officials and county supervisors that waterfront property owners are in many of our lake-rich areas are a big part of the local economy in that way, protecting that water, keeping it clean, and even encouraging communities to move in directions that create BMPs, best practices that create cleaner water, helps that economic base at the local level.
Kate, you've also spent quite a bit of time researching creating greater efficiencies in water sustainability and growing food. Explain a little bit about the crop or drop work that you've been involved with.
One of the things that I really love about the crop per drop work is that it really gets down to what are we trying to do on fields? And what we're trying to do is grow food. And if we can grow more food with the same amount of water, we're functionally getting more food bang for our water buck. And sometimes we can reduce the water we're using, but more frequently we can actually get more food for that water. It's an easier intervention a lot of the time. It depends on where in the world you're working. And what that does is make the pie bigger. There's a finite amount of water in the world, and we can divide it up in different ways, but we can't make more in any real way. But what we can do is use that water better and get more crop per drop. And it turns out there's actually a lot of places where we're getting pretty low crop per drop. Sometimes that's because people aren't using enough nutrients on fields. Sometimes it's because of bad soils. Sometimes it's because of crop disease. But for whatever reason, it means that a lot of water is being used and we're not getting food for it. I actually think that that's great, because the same way that it's easier to get a really poorly performing student to do just a little bit better and pass the class than it sometimes is to get that A student up to an A plus, we can do a really good job of getting some of these poor performing farms doing better and really making more food with the same amount of water.
Can you give us an example of one way to improve the crop rotation?
Sure thing. So there are lots of places in Africa where there's not a regular supply of nitrogen. So there's not enough fertilizer. And some of the farmers there use manure, but it turns out that if you're not giving your cow enough nutrients, your manure usually doesn't have enough nutrients in it either. And so when we can help farmers get access to nutrients, and this doesn't even mean what putting on nutrients in the state sometimes means. Oftentimes people are microdosing with nutrients. So if you think about just a bottle cap of a 1 liter soda bottle, just a little bit of nitrogen in there can help crops grow and you can get much better yield, and you're really using the same amount of water on your field.
Eric Olson.
Yeah, I mean, this ties into this global discussion about sustainability too, right? What the point Kate is making is that we can use these tools to look at the whole planet and figure out, can we have our cake and eat it too? If you talk to some serious scientists, they'll say, we're in this period of what we call overshoot, where we're consuming resources faster than they replenish themselves. We need to calibrate how we do things if we really want to sustain this for a couple additional billion people who are scheduled to be born, you know, in the next couple of decades. How are we going to feed them all? If we can't answer that question optimistically or positively, I think it's kind of a depressing situation. So I'm really excited that Kate can share this type of research that says, you know what, this might actually be possible. If we can, like she said, move some people up the chain in terms of how they're getting more crop per drop, we can actually sustain the population on the planet and have the water resources necessary for sustaining native fisheries and sustaining the natural ecosystems that we all just know need to sustain as well.
Kate, thank you so much for being with us on Route 51 today. I'm sorry that you can't be with us longer, but people can hear more of what you have to present at the Wisconsin Lakes Partnership Convention on April 11th. At 9 o'clock in Stevens Point. Kate Brauman is the lead scientist at the Global Watery Initiative at the University of Minnesota's Institute on the Environment. When we return, we'll talk about backyard biodiversity and shoreline restoration with University of Delaware entomologist Dr. Douglas Talamay. You can join the conversation as well at 800-780-9742. I'm Rick Ryer, and this is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
From the fountains and the mountains comes the water running cool and clear and blue. And it flows down from the hills and it goes down to the towns and passes through. When it gets down to the cities, then the water turns into a dirty gray. It's poisoned and polluted by the people as it flows along its way. Don't go near the water, children, see the fish all dead up on the shore. Don't go near the water, water isn't water anymore.
River's high and it's hard to ford. Can't cross the river, can't open no doors. The only thing to do is take to swim, but the current's strong and the light is dim.
We're back on Route 51. I'm Rick Ryer with Eric Olson and Patrick Goggin from UW Extension Lakes. Joining us now is Dr. Douglas Talamay. Doug is a professor in the Department of Entomology and Wildlife Ecology at the University of Delaware, where he's taught for nearly 40 years. He's the author of Bringing Nature Home: How You Can Sustain Wildlife with Native Plants. His research demonstrates the enduring connections between plants and the insects that feed on them. Douglas Talamay, thank you so much, and welcome to Route 51.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
If you have a question or comment about shoreline restoration, plant insect connections, biodiversity, or protecting our waters, you can call us now at 800-780-9742. Doug Talamay, you'll be speaking at the Wisconsin Lakes Partnership Convention on April 12th. Your talk is titled, A Guide to Restoring the Little Things That Run the World. Give us a glimpse into your world of little things.
It's not just my world. Little things really do run the world. I take that phrase from Edward O. Wilson, who wrote a paper in 1987, saying, what would happen if we lost insects and other invertebrates to planet Earth? And his predictions were dire. It would change life entirely, including the loss of humans. We would lose our flowering plants, which would change food webs and destroy the flow of energy through terrestrial ecosystems, so that you would lose mammals and amphibians and birds and reptiles. Our decomposers would disappear, so the earth would essentially rot instead of turning over nutrients quickly. Of course, all of those things would mean the end of humanity. So it's these are important issues, and fortunately, we're just starting to recognize them. The media are picking up studies that have shown we've got serious insect declines around the world. And I see that as a positive step one, because we can't solve these problems until we recognize them.
Well, your research indicates that biodiversity has been shifting from natural areas and parks to our neighborhoods and cities. And you say that America has turned 54% of the lower 48 states into a suburban an urban area, 41% more into various forms of agricultural land, totaling 95% of our country's landmass. How has this affected wildlife and native plants?
It's hit it very, very hard. Our managed landscapes, all those landscapes that we've taken over and managed for human needs, have changed the native plant communities drastically. You can just picture your own yard and look at the ornamentals that we put in our yard. Most of it typically is lawn, which doesn't do very much ecologically for us. And then, at least where I live, about almost 80% of the plants we put in our yards are ornamentals from Asia. So we're landscaping for aesthetics instead of for ecological function. And I understand why we do that. Plants are beautiful. We want to decorate our yards. But when we do that everywhere, we've got to include the vital roles that plants play in our ecosystems, because they are far more than just decorations. And we haven't been doing that. So,
and that's a lesson we've learned here on our shorelands, and why we do shoreline restoration. So that lawn ethic and the idea of suburbia has in many times been brought to our lakefronts. And unfortunately, the canopy of trees, shrubs, and wildflowers and grasses that was on that lakeshore, intercepting water, acting as a buffer to nutrients entering the lake, keeping that water clean, was modified, as Doug says. And so we've learned the lesson of how valuable those native plants are, and through shoreline restoration, put that woody plants back along with wildflowers, grasses, and sedges to restore those functions that Doug's talking about.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what are the myths of native plants?
The myths. One myth is that they're wild and messy and they're not pretty.
Yeah.
Many of them have not been selected for aesthetics specifically. So some are more leggy than others. It's a partial myth, but we certainly have plenty of beautiful plants. What I'm trying to emphasize here, though, is we can have functional landscapes that are also attractive, but we've got to lower our expectations in terms of aesthetics. We need to build landscapes that enhance local ecosystems rather than degrade them. And if we only function on beauty, we're not going to be able to do that. And the reason we need to do it at home now in our managed landscapes is because so much of our natural world is where we live and where we work and where we play. Those parks and preserves that are out there are not big enough. They are not connected enough. They're too isolated to sustain the nature that runs our ecosystems. So we have to start doing that where we live now. And if you only pick the prettiest plant from Asia, you're going to fail.
You know, and everyone can do their part. I think of a farmer up in Three Lakes who's an organic cranberry grower and struggles with pollinators helping with his crop. So his solution was to plant natives around the berms and the facility of the farm to enhance those beneficial insects and to bolster that support for his cranberry crop. So we all can find ways to use native plants to help us achieve these goals.
Well, let's take an average Wisconsin homeowner in a suburban environment or in the city. What can that person do to restore a state of biodiversity?
I usually start with a recommendation of looking at the area you have in lawn and thinking about reducing that area. So around me, there are acres and acres in lawn. We have an area in lawn in the U.S. the size of New England. So can you cut your lawn area in half? And how are you going to do that? You're going to do that by adding plants, and you're going to add ecologically powerful plants, ecologically productive plants that maintain food webs, so that you're producing the caterpillars that your little chickadees need or they can't breed in your yard. And that's just an example. You're going to add plants that sequester carbon. You're going to add plants that manage our watershed. What is the last one? Oh, and that support those pollinators that have, you know, we have 4,000 species of native pollinators. It's more than just the honeybee. We've got to maintain those species to pollinate those cranberries and everything else that's out there. And it's specific plants that will do that best. All plants are not equal in those functions. So that's why lawn's not going to do it. We've got to get the plants back into our yard.
And we're fortunate enough to have even a grant system here in Wisconsin that can support some of this work. So if folks go to healthylakeswi.com, they can find out how to do a native planting and take a first step to do a 350-square-foot planting and get grant support to do it.
Eric.
That's great.
Yeah, and you know, Doug suggested half of your lawn coming out. We recognize that not everybody's going to do that right away, you know, take out half of their lawn. But maybe we could borrow from these ideas of like cleaning up and decluttering your life. Take a look at your lawn and ask of different parts of your lawn, does it spark joy? Is this a really great spot? If it's a part that you have a hard time growing grass in anyway, guess what? Take it out of grass. Start growing other things there, because you'll find that other plants probably do prosper where you can't get grass to grow. So why not start by just looking at places that are sort of marginal anyway in terms of grass production? Because all you're doing is battling an uphill fight to try to get grass to grow where it doesn't want to grow anyway.
And you don't want to spend an hour and a half mowing your lawn every couple of days in the spring.
Right. I mean, there are some reasons why people have lawns. I especially think, you know, people with dogs and people with kids, it's nice to have a place to run around. But I'll tell you what, if you look at your lawn and figure out, well, what space are they actually using and what space can I take out of turf and put into something else? Yeah, that really should reduce your year-to-year sort of grass maintenance program.
Doug, tell us a little bit about your website, Bringing Nature Home. I'm on there now, and there's a section where folks can go and take a look at what plants should I plant in my yard based upon zip code. I think that's pretty interesting.
Right. We've created a tool that is now on the National Wildlife Federation website called Native Plant Finder. And you put in your zip code, and the ranked plants, the ones that are most ecologically powerful, will pop up for your county, both the ranked woody plants and the ranked herbaceous plants. And it happens at the genus level. So number one in most places would be oaks. It'll say, you know, oaks, quercus, but that gives you a lot of choices. And then you can focus on those. What we found by making these lists for all over the country is that only 5% of our local plant genera are producing about 75% of the food that drives our food webs. So we're calling those keystone plants, liking them to the keystone in a Roman arch. If you take that keystone out, the whole arch falls down. Well, if we build landscapes that don't include these powerhouse plants, the whole food web falls apart. So that's what I would start with if I'm trying to reduce my lawn. I would pick some of these keystone plants and just start planting them. And you're absolutely right. Don't try to do it overnight. It's a hobby. You pick at it over the years. And if you do that, you can do it with very low cost. And if you do it slowly, your neighbors won't even notice you have less lawn. You're just growing more plants, and they won't object to it at all. The lawn you do keep should be manicured. You know, mow that lawn. And that's a cue for care. It shows that you are a good citizen, you care about the neighborhood, you're not just letting things go. That's not what we're promoting.
Doug, you point out, too, that the State Natural Heritage Centers estimate that as many as 33,000 species of plants and animals in the U.S. are now imperiled or otherwise too rare to perform the role in the ecosystem. They're now considered functionally extinct. Is it too late for them?
Well, you know, if there are a few around, we do have some very good examples of bringing species back, the bald eagle, and, you know, there's some other charismatic species. Most of the species are invertebrates, and they do respond very rapidly to providing what they need. They need a place to live, and they need something to eat. And we have to stop poisoning them. I mean, that's a given. So the monarch butterfly is a perfect example these days. The entire nation is focused on saving monarchs. The only reason monarchs are disappearing is we've taken away the milkweeds that they need to reproduce. I shouldn't say the only reason. We've also taken away the forage they need to fly to Mexico. And by forage, I mean they're nectaring all the way down. So things like goldenrod and fall asters are perfect to help those monarchs get down to their overwintering site in Mexico. But that's an example of a host plant specialist. The only thing that's going to keep monarchs here are milkweeds. So if we wage war on milkweeds and kill them out, we're going to lose the monarch. And that is true for 90% of the insects that eat plants. We need to keep the specific plants that they are ecologically tied to. If we bring plants over from Asia and allow them to escape, I mean, you know, 86% of our woody invasive plants are escapees from our gardens, and now our natural areas are filled with these things like buckthorn and bush honeysuckle. They're not supporting any insects because our insects have not adapted to them. They don't have the defenses to get around their defensive chemicals. So it's very important. That's where the native plant connection comes in. You've got to have native plants, and you've got to have those powerhouse natives because not all natives are equally productive.
Patrick, what can lakefront and riverfront property owners do to reverse this?
Yeah, so I think just as the challenge was put forth, take a look at your property. See if there is a little piece of lawn that you could do without, and maybe consider taking a first step with a small native planting, utilizing the information on the Healthy Lakes website. There's 6 planting plans in a guide there on that website that have the plant list all ready for you, whether it's pollinators or a shaded situation or even low growing to keep that view corridor. So take a look at that, and I encourage them to take a first step.
Now, go ahead, Eric.
Well, I was going to say, one of the things we're also doing is trying to promote just more propagation of native plants. It turns out they're not too hard to start from seed and to grow your own. What we want to do is actually create an army of people who are propagating these native plants. So we're having a workshop at the convention on April 10th that basically is called Starting a Native Plant Growing Volunteer Program. We're borrowing this idea from several years of experience in Dane County, where volunteers get together, they collect milk jugs, I believe. They use the milk jugs as a way to seed these plants. And then they just grow lots and lots of native plants. They can then give them away. They can sell them. They can use them on their own landscape. But we need sort of an army of people who are committed to reproducing native plants. So that workshop on April 10th is going to be one way to get people started.
Doug, if you could tell me in just a few minutes, looking ahead 10 years from now, what is your vision?
I used to joke that I wanted to re-landscape the U.S. and then I realized that's not a joke. That's exactly what I want to do.
There you go.
I have been talking about this for 12 years now, and so I have that perspective. And I do see a big change. I see, this interest in native plants is not a fad. People recognize that we're losing species, and that is one of the key elements in terms of restoring them. They're recognizing that the number of species in our ecosystems determines how well that ecosystem functions. That we need functional ecosystems. We humans, they produce those ecosystem services. So all of this stuff is filtering into our general culture. And what I'm hoping to see in the next 10 years is reaching a threshold where the homeowner who puts a lot of plants into his yard is the norm. He's not the outlier. that we don't have ridiculous homeowner association rules that say you got to have all plants from Asia and giant lawn, and it's got to be cut within half an inch. And we can get rid of those things that a lot of these rules were established in the 70s, and it was the idea of maintaining property value. But I want to see the landscape that is filled with productive plants be what everybody's aspiring to instead of what we're fighting against. If we can get there in 10 years, I'll be very happy.
One of the things I thought about as we're preparing for this program is we were talking about Asian plants and things that people put in the yards. Is the real onslaught of unwanted, I'm putting that in quotes, insects that just devour those expensive plants. I'm thinking of the Japanese beetles that we've had over the past few years and other Asian beetles. How are those actually beneficial insects? Or, again, is this what you're speaking to specifically?
Yeah, no, I'm not. We don't want any non-native insects. We do want insects because they are running the world, but not non-native insects. And the reason is that, you know, the Japanese beetle and the gypsy moth and the hemlock woolly adelgid and the Asian longhorn beetle and the emerald ash borer, all these huge troublemakers are troublemakers because we brought them over here without any of their natural enemies to keep them in check. No species can reproduce unchecked by it's usually predators and parasites without causing problems. So when you move things from continent to continent, you leave the enemies behind, and that just causes huge problems. So yes, we want insects, but we do not want non-native insects any more than we want non-native plants. It's the same reason non-native plants are running amok. They don't have their natural enemies here.
And I think it's the old lesson of biodiversity of sort of spreading your wealth around. Years ago, it was the trees lined just with elm trees, or the streets lined with elm trees. And so we had all this elm tree, and it was just begging for something to go wrong. And that happened when Dutch elm disease came in and started wiping them out. The lesson should be diversify, get more of a mix of plants out there, and don't put all your eggs in one basket. So I can't help but – and then what we're trying to argue for is to use native plants as that source of diversity. We're really blessed, I think, in the Midwest to have so many native plants that do work on the landscape, that are going to provide beauty, that are going to provide diversity. Let's just embrace that and run with it.
In another large portion of property owners, in addition to individuals and families, our city, county, state governments, federal governments, how do we work with our governmental folks to, again, look back, look into biodiversity versus making a city park or county park beautiful, if you will? How do we convince them?
Again, I don't want to make it sound like it's a trade-off. You can have a beautiful county park that is dominated by native plants. Mm-hmm. And then this is an important place to bring up the idea of compromise. We just finished a study, my graduate student Desiree Narango, looking at chickadees in the suburbs of Washington, D.C., and looking at their breeding success in terms of the landscape in which they were breeding. The most important thing she found is that when you exceed 30% non-native plants in the landscape, the chickadee populations are unsustainable. They just keep declining and declining, because those landscapes aren't making enough insects. So in other words, if you have 70% native plants, you can have sustainable reproduction in your yard. But that gives us the opportunity for compromise, so that if you need that striking crepe myrtle to draw the eye in, you can do that as long as that's not the only plant in your yard. If you balance it with those productive plants. And this gives us the opportunity to be creative with our landscape designs. It's really not a native versus non-native thing. It's a productive plant, ecologically productive plant versus not ecologically productive plant. We cannot afford to build entire, hundreds of square miles of ecologically dead landscapes. We've got to use those productive plants, and those are always native plants.
Doug, thank you for joining us on Route 51 today. Doug Tellamy is the professor of entomology at the University of Delaware. He'll be speaking at the Wisconsin Lakes Partnership Convention at 9 a.m. on April 12th in Stevens Point. When we return, we'll talk about the convention with Eric Olson and Patrick Goggin from UW Extension Lakes. You can join the conversation as well at 800-780-9742. I'm Rick Ryer, and this is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Dad's hot air. Well, I was 3 years old, splashing everywhere, and so began my love affair with water.
We're back on Route 51. I'm Rick Ryer. Eric Olson and Patrick Goggin from UW Extension Lakes are with us. You can join us as well at 800-780-9742. The Wisconsin Lakes Partnership Convention runs from April 10th through the 13th at the Holiday Inn and Convention Center in Stevens Point. Eric, tell us about this year's theme and what people can expect to experience.
Sure. The theme this year is Paying It Forward. And so this is off of that idea that sometimes we do things not because we get an immediate response from it or a return from that, but instead we're doing it to be good to the world. And then eventually sometimes those favors return back to us. So the idea, again, of planting native plants is a good example, because you put them out there just to plant some native plants, but you might be blessed in years to come by butterflies that now are attracted to those native plants. So we're just trying to get people to think down the line of paying it forward with little favors. The Lakes Convention is really – it's open to anyone who loves lakes and rivers in Wisconsin, and I would imagine that's just about everybody in the state. So it's not exclusive. It's open to the public. And we bring together educators, scientists, natural resource managers, and just citizens who want to be a part of the long-term solution for managing lakes and rivers. Wisconsin is unique in that lakes and rivers belong to everybody. So nobody can say, well, this is my lake. You may think it's your lake, but actually the lakes and rivers belong to the public. And we all have a part to play in protecting and restoring those lakes and rivers. The convention is where you go to figure out what part can you play and what resources are there to help you out.
And Pat, as you mentioned earlier in the program, you'll be presenting at a couple of these sessions throughout the convention itself. One is in designing living habitats. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I look forward to that. Heidi Natura is a Chicago-based landscape architect who's going to come up and help us learn what she's done. She's done miles of shoreline restoration at the Chicago Botanical Gardens, working with a team of folks there, for example, as well as other projects throughout the Midwest. So she'll take us through the lessons learned about designing these living habitats, considerations about site assessment, and how we take a look at that patch of lawn and maybe make that consideration of how to turn it into a living habitat to support wildlife and clean water. And so Heidi and I will be working with 36 folks who join us for that workshop to talk through those themes and give them ideas of how to do that.
Yeah, and I want to point out, like, the convention is open and accessible in the sense that you can join us for as little or as much as you want to. So the workshop that Patrick mentioned is just a half-day workshop on Wednesday, April 10th. If that's all you want to participate in, just sign up for that. There's a modest fee that covers the cost of snacks and breaks that we provide and the space at the Holiday Inn Convention Center. But we try to keep it really affordable. If you want to come for workshops on Wednesday and the full day of conference on Thursday and Friday, again, there is a fee associated with it, but we try to balance it out to make it affordable to everybody. But if you sign up for that whole thing, you're going to learn a lot about lakes. So we do have a lot of hardcore people who do join us for the whole conference. But I want to point out that people can join us for one day or half a day if that's all they really can and want to do.
Well, I imagine, too, there are quite a few opportunities for folks to network with each other, people that property owners as well as the experts in the fields. Tell us some things that have happened over past years and what you expect to see again this year.
Sure. Part of what people are able to do is network with the staff from the Department of Natural Resources. Wisconsin is so fortunate to have such professional and experienced staff at the state level who help take care of lakes and rivers. But oftentimes, you know, you don't know who these people are. How would you find out who they are? They work in an office in Rhineland, or they work in Madison. at the convention, you'll basically see dozens of them all together. And if they can't answer your question, they can actually walk you over to their colleague who can answer your question. That's just amazing. We see that time and again where people are just stuck on a question about their lake. It could be about, you know, what kind of pier should I be putting in on my cabin? Or it may be about, you know, can we make this boat landing at our lake a little more lake friendly and deal with stormwater and put some native plants in there? Well, you got to connect those people. So there's a lot of just spontaneous connections that happen really in between the sessions. They happen during the breaks. They happen during dinner. It's unpredictable. But I'll tell you, when you get these people together, and each year we have between 500 and 600 people at the Holiday Inn Convention Center, it's inevitable that you're going to find someone who can answer your questions.
There's a lot of space around the facility for side conversations and that networking. So it's always a fun to watch those conversations going on and that learning and from each other. Lake groups are really good about leaning on each other to learn what's working in their community and passing that along to another group.
And I can see the benefit, obviously, of networking in the convention like this is that you have the convention, but then that relationship continues on to the next convention and beyond that. One of the opportunities that I'm really interested in hearing more about is the larger citizen scientist programs, specifically the Citizen Lake Monitoring Network. What does that involve, Eric?
Sure. The Citizen Lake Monitoring Network is volunteers who go through some training in order to be active volunteers who monitor water quality on their lakes. The basic level that we think about this is tracking how clear the water is on the lake over the course of a summer. So they go out a couple of times. They use what's called a Secchi disc. They drop it into the water and measure how deep does it go down before it disappears. That measures clarity. But that's just the beginning, understanding clarity. We actually have almost 1,000 volunteers who also go out and measure chemistry in lakes. And they can also monitor native plants. There's also a stream program. You can learn about that at the convention as well.
And we have a caller on the line from Washburn. Hi, Leah. How are you?
Yeah, hi. I think we need to look at our farming practices and why we have a big decline in insect population, the use of Roundup, pesticides, herbicides, and our insect population that are depending on the pollen from these plants, and also all the runoff into the lakes and streams of all these toxic chemicals that surely affect the health, just not on humans, but also on our insects and our wildlife.
Yeah, well, that topic I know is going to come up. One of our streams on Thursday from 10 to 40 to noon is the Wisconsin Bumblebee Brigade, a new statewide monitoring project that's getting after what's going on with this bumblebee situation and our pollinators in general, and I'm sure that topic will come up.
We also see
all the Roundup Ready corn and soybeans and all that is like devastating to our whole environment, and it's not just in the water and on the plants, it's in our food and in the air.
Yeah, we're starting to see some people actually form organizations that are like lake associations, but they're actually farmers. And these are what we're calling producer-led watershed groups. These are farmers who actually want to try something different. So they're a little bit skeptical, just like you are, that this sort of monocrop and chemical-based farming is the answer. And instead, they want to experiment with, you know, putting in native plants in a mix with their plants. They use what are called cover crops. So instead of just growing corn, they're growing other things in between the corn. They're not tilling over the land as much. Mm-hmm. That's a big part of where things are headed in Wisconsin. And we find that lake and river organizations are sort of like a yin-yang relationship with these producer-led watershed groups that they're learning from each other and they're trying to support each other. Because the farmers who do take these steps, that's seen as a risk, okay? That can be risky for them to not just do what everybody else is doing. Who's going to support them? In the Madison area...
Well, they've been kind of pushed into this monocrop, ready...
Yeah, the economics kind of push them that way. So,
and now it's really hard to go back, but that's what we need to support, for organic farms, small organic farms, and not give subsidies to these big corporations that are poisoning our planet.
Yep. So in like the Madison area in Dane County, we see a good relationship between an organization called Clean Lakes Alliance and the Yahara Pride Farmers. And basically, they really exemplify this yin and yang relationship of providing some resources to the farmers to take some risks and try something out. that's probably going to be better for the environment. So we're excited.
Definitely.
Thank you, Leah, for your call.
Well, that sounds – thank you so much.
Eric, where can people find more information about the convention?
Sure. An easy-to-remember webpage is wisconsinlakes.org. That's the webpage for our partner organization called Wisconsin Lakes, and they'll have a banner right there that'll link you right into the convention. Or if you just Googled Wisconsin Lakes Partnership Convention or Water Action Volunteers Symposium, that should get you to the right place. Online, you'll find the full agenda. We actually have well over 50 different concurrent sessions, plus the workshops I mentioned on Wednesday. We have an awards banquet on Thursday. It's all there.
And that's all the time we have for today on Route 51. Thank you to our guests, Eric Olson and Patrick Goggin from UW Extension Lakes, Dr. Douglas Talamy of the University of Delaware, and Dr. Kate Brauman of the Global Watery Initiative at the University of Minnesota. Thanks to our producer, Melissa Benchowell, and our on-air producer, Jane Ritger. John Altenberg wrote the Route 51 theme. Special music today from Cullum Graham, Johnny Cash, Horseshoes and Hand Grenades, Gordon Lightfoot, Brad Paisley, and Styx. Next week, we welcome our new host, Shireen Seward. Until then, we're heading out of town.